Hello, human peoples. You're listening to the podcast network of Gamefully Unemployed. Support us and gain access to great exclusive podcasts like Fox Mulder is a Maniac, Tom and Jeff Watch Batman, Star Trek The Next Futurama, and our latest show, Spiel Boys. Head over to patreon.com/gamefullyunemployed. We do game streaming, movie nights with our patrons every Friday night, and you can even commission your own podcast about anything you want. Literally anything, within reason, and we have to do it. You are quite frankly out of excuses not to go visit patreon.com/gamefullyunemployed. That's patreon.com/gamefully unemployed, which is spelled like it sounds.
Nice.
I fixed its little red wagon.
Anyway, vroom vroom.
Vroom vroom, Dave.
Hi, everybody.
Hello, everyone.
My name is David Bell.
My name is Tom Ryman.
And we just watched American Graffiti.
American Graffiti.
This is when Ron Howard fucks the graffiti, right? He fucks him.
Yep.
Eugene Levy walks in. Yeah. That's the movie.
He fucks a pie while Mark Echo tags him.
Grab that special one and jump into your candy-colored custom or your screaming machine, cruise downtown, and catch American Graffiti.
American Graffiti.
Baby, what's that?
It's a movie.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
Go back in time.
Where were you in 62?
Is that you in that beautiful car? Jeez, what a waste of machinery.
What are we doing? Hey.
I don't know.
Big ol'... Big old thank you to Harrison Millie. Harrison Millie, our Patreon producers, who
demanded that we do this film.
Yeah, to watch this George Lucas pre-Star Wars, post-THX film that I'm just going to go ahead and say I never seen. Well, that wasn't good grammar. I never seen.
Yep.
I've never done seen this movie until recently, until this podcast.
That's interesting. I have seen this before.
Yeah. You said you saw it a while ago, though, right?
It has been a while since I've revisited it, yes. But I remembered most of it. It's a pretty...
Okay.
It's like a proto-Dazed and Confused. I think it was the first one of that type of film, where it was just, let's capture... It's the director setting out to capture a memory of like a moment in time, like a night they had in high school. I think this is the first movie to do that, and a couple more have done it since then, Dazed and Confused most famously, but a few others have copied this sort of, you know,
right.
template.
It's interesting to me. I looked into it. It was, I think Coppola is the producer. I forget.
He is. Yeah. No, this was back
challenged
when
Lucas
to
make something after THX. He was like, make something for everybody. And this is what he made. Basically, this was his attempt at like a broad comedy, I guess.
Huh, that's interesting. What I was going to say is Coppola produced it, because all those dudes, this is the beginning of that like auteur movement in the 70s. All these dudes were friends, like Coppola and Lucas, and then eventually Spielberg.
I want to talk about that for sure. And like, it's just funny because you bring up the Hangout movie. It's just funny when you think about like, okay, the first like, Dazed and Confused was the first Hanging Out movie I ever saw. And then after that, shortly after Clerks, which is, of course, Kevin Smith is so inspired by Star Wars. And it's just weird to think that, like, oh, yeah. And the first person to make a Clerks, essentially, is Lucas. Yeah. I was just going to say, I knew nothing about this movie because, and I now know why. Because, you know, when you haven't seen a movie, you get context clues and you figure it out. I never got anything. And I realize now it's like, oh, because nothing technically happens in this, that, you know, like it's a Hangout movie.
Yeah.
So like whenever I'd see references to it, it didn't seem like the references were about anything specific, like, oh, the scene, the big
right
scene,
yeah, when they're this... it's hard to take a scene of this movie out of context is what you're saying.
Yeah exactly. What were you gonna say?
I was gonna say, like, it's a little bit of a mind with Clerks, because one thing I didn't remember revisiting this movie is this movie is pretty dark. It's not a necessarily favorable view of nostalgia.
No.
Which is very surprising for George Lucas from somebody watching this movie in 2024. I know he was very, like, he had only made, I think, THX at that point. So he, you know, which is this weird dystopic sci-fi movie. He could have been any kind of filmmaker at this point. he didn't even know what he was going to be.
Right.
And it's interesting that he had so many really cuttingly dark things to say about Americana.
Yeah, in my opinion. I guess.
It's not like overt. It's basically it's the Luke Skywalker of America, right? Because it's not as pristine as you remembered is yes. part of what he's saying.
But it's hard to tell because it felt like a lot of glorification, and I want to get into
for
that.
For sure.
But there's definitely darkness at the end, which is
I would
argue undercut by the use of Beach Boys, where it's like Beach Boys going on the screen and they're like, he died in Vietnam.
I think it's very hilarious. Intentional, but yeah.
I know. It's just very funny.
Yeah,
you're right. But it's I know what you're saying, which is like I guess to me what it felt like he was saying is like, look at this when we were all happy go lucky before the world crushed us. In 10 years, I guess. Because this also was... This was made in, 73. And it takes place in the 60s.
62. It's also the eve of Vietnam is another big thing.
Right. So it's sort of about the loss of innocence, right? Of, mm-hmm. look how we young and happy we were before shit hit the fan.
There's even one point where Richard Dreyfuss's character... They point out that his, one of his ambitions, one of his goals is to shake hands with President Kennedy. It's 1962.
Right.
President Kennedy's not going to be around for very much longer.
Exactly.
There's this darkness looming over everything. Yeah.
Yeah, it's about this idea. It's weird because I still am making a movie about 10 years ago feels so self-indulgent to me. I compared it to what if we made a movie about 2010? But I actually...
However, happened in this 10 years.
That's what I was going to say. Sorry. Had you made a movie about 1999 in 2005, that actually would have been significant.
Yeah.
So it makes more sense in context.
Like that Robert Pattinson movie. I think that's actually the year it came out. It came out around the mid-aughts, I'm pretty sure.
I didn't like this movie, Tom.
Really?
Well, okay. It was nominated for so many Academy Awards.
Was
and
it?
I know why. Yes.
I didn't actually look much up about this movie. Really? Okay.
Yeah. Which I would actually argue it's not incredibly well shot, but that's whatever. I mean, it's indie. I don't know. There's choices that I'm I don't know why you made that choice, but it's nitpicky in my, it doesn't matter. I get why people loved this when it came out. I just don't think I think there's two hits against it and then there's one hit for it. And two of them have to do with time, meaning that I don't think this movie stands the test of time completely. But I also
there's
think
definitely
it's fascinating
parts of
because
it that have aged. Yeah.
Yeah. I also think it's fascinating because of time, because you mentioned how they're all friends and it's man, Richard Dreyfuss is 3 years away from Jaws, or 2 years away from Jaws. These people are about to rule the world. You know what I mean? And it's interesting to watch a teen hangout movie.
Harrison Ford, who's barely a character in this movie.
Yeah, it's so weird to watch this underdog teen hangout movie. It's sort of watching old Sam Raimi or old Peter Jackson, right? And being you don't even know what you're going to be doing. You're going to be making Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, I mean,
it's that.
Yeah, Ron Howard is one of the main characters. This is pre-Happy Days, and it's, pre his directing. And
so it's interesting to watch it in that context, I think.
I think it's also, I kind of like that these movies exist as self-indulgent as they are, because they're little time capsules. They sort of give you little time capsules of, and I think they give you little time capsules of teen culture. And I think one of the realizations I had watching this movie is this is also kind of the era, the 50s, 60s is the era when the teenager started to become a thing, right? Teen life and teen culture. So that's, I think, maybe one reason why this is one of the first movies of its kind is it's just because this brand of nostalgia, I don't think particularly existed yet. Until the 60s. And then, of course, he made this movie in the 70s.
It is kind of the birth of nostalgia because...
In this form of nostalgia.
Well, it's
I think
funny
the nostalgia for high school, I think, in the way that we understand it and Anyway, I'm sorry. What were you, finish your thought.
Well, no, it's interesting because war and nostalgia go hand in hand. During, like, that's part of how nostalgia, the concept of nostalgia came to be. I think it was World War One.
Yeah.
The idea that people would leave their town, and when they'd come back, their town wouldn't exist anymore. And it was this, like, deep, like, it was a psychological, it was like a diagnosis when it first, when we first had the concept of nostalgia, which is like this idea of like missing the past so bad that it hurts you. Now it's like, you know, it's a little less that, but I mean, it varies, right? Like you look at the pandemic, like I think it's nostalgia is worse when trauma happens, right? Where
that's a lot of what triggers it, right?
Yes. Yeah. I believe so.
I'm not a brain pervert. I mean, everybody, like, I think everybody gets a little spark of endorphin or joy or whatever when they see, like, oh, like you see a thing you liked. Oh, I haven't seen this Garfield in a, you know, whatever it was. Like, oh, right. This fucking Ninja Turtle. I haven't seen this guy in 20. I remember this guy. This is cool. But like the way that Richard Dreyfuss is sort of experiencing it in this movie, or like, I guess like, when you get sort of like obsessive with it, I think it's because of dissatisfaction with where you are. Right. So it's like, I think it's all born out of dissatisfaction with where you are for one reason or another. And I just,
it's a few things, right? You're younger. So it's like,
the world
was
simpler.
Younger.
You had less responsibilities
and more energy. Yeah.
More energy. The world seemed more possible. Your death seemed further away.
Yep.
There's a number of things.
Yeah. And then, usually when it's triggered by trauma, it's also like, and the bad thing didn't happen
right then. Before the thing had happened. Yeah. Like I find myself, you know, when you, for example, they don't always need to be extreme trauma, but like when you lose a person, you start clocking time before and after that happened. Like you look at, oh man, I remember April 19th, 2020, that this person was still here, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, tied to Vietnam makes a lot of sense. I guess I should, again, I recognize, I don't think this is a bad movie. I do think it's, I think there's a conversation about whether or not it's overrated, because it clearly got a lot of praise at the time, but I don't really care about that conversation.
Neither do I, because none of it affected my opinion. Like, when you said it was nominated for X number of Academy Awards, I didn't even know that. So
yeah, exactly.
I had no concept of the prestige of this film. I just know it as George Lucas's movie other than Star Wars.
Yes.
his teen movie.
Right. And by the way, like I mentioned, I love Dazed and Confused, right? And so I asked myself that question. I was like, why do I like Dazed and Confused and I don't enjoy this?
See, I'm only very okay. I'm pretty mid on Dazed and Confused.
Oh, okay. I really enjoyed it.
I don't love this movie either. It's just Dazed and Confused is also one that didn't grab me.
It sounds like you liked it more than me, though, right?
Yeah, no, I was actually surprised with as much as I enjoyed it this time, because I remembered the plot, like I remembered everything that happens. Because as you pointed out, not that much happens. There's like a couple of things. It's really we follow four guys, basically. The two lead women characters do not get epilogues. We don't know what the fuck happens to Lori or Carol.
Women don't have a great time in this.
They sure don't, Dave.
Yeah, it shares a lot of the DNA of, like, for example, Superbad. I was surprised to realize there's a Superbad plot where the nerd, one of the threads is that the quote unquote nerdy kid,
Charles Martin Smith.
Yeah, he gets to borrow, the character's name is Steve's car. Mm-hmm. And basically, because Steve's leaving, they don't say where they're going. They just, like, him and old Ricky Dreyfuss are leaving.
They're going off to college, which is somewhere. Yeah. They're in the Valley in California in 1962. They never, I think they say where they're going.
It was like a kind of an abstract where it's like they're leaving.
I feel like they mentioned it like once or twice, because like there's a subplot where Dreyfuss got a scholarship from the Moose Lodge. He keeps having to deal with these Moose Lodge guys.
But you're right.
It's more important as an abstract. They're leaving town, and Dreyfuss has a lot of anxiety about it. And Steve, Ron Howard, is like, we got to go.
And so this kid has a McLovin thread. he gets the car and it changes his life. He gets this hot lady. They go out. He tries to buy alcohol. It ends in a calamity. That was the first
Debbie's
thing I really
pretty
liked.
Incredible. Like, I want to know more about Debbie.
Yeah. That the buying booze scene was, I think, the first scene that I liked, when I was like, this is fun. I like this.
Oh, really? I liked all the stuff. I'm sorry.
No, it's all right. But that's one of the threats, basically, is like he gets like this night where this car changes him. And then, of course, he lies to Debbie. And again, very McLovin, right? Like, that's a very McLovin plot. And then at the end, Debbie's sort of like, it's all right. Like, it's McLovin with the cops having like this grand night.
Right. He winds up having a cool night because everything goes wrong.
Yeah.
Like, he's in a fist fight with some greasers that stole his car. And
yeah, exactly.
Oh, man. It's going to go a lot worse for him a few years later in The Untouchables.
Wait, is also, does this guy, which is, I think he's the one who dies in Vietnam at the epilogue.
He is the one who dies in Vietnam. Yes, he is.
It's very funny. Yeah.
Because he's the other one that didn't go to college. It's one of the things the movie is saying.
Right, yeah. And then we get, Ronald Howard, who
Ronald
is this
Howard.
So, like, this, I should just say it out front. One of my biggest problems with the movie is I didn't find most of the characters likable. Ron Howard breaks up. Basically,
he's the arch one,
girlfriend.
Right? Like, I was in my memory, I disliked Dreyfuss more than I like him fine in this, and I still like John Milner.
Yeah, I mean, one of the first things Dreyfuss says in this is, "So many ugly chicks in this town," and I'm like, "Well, I don't like you now." Like they're still.
I took that as being a little ironic because he's being a little ironic when he says it, because it's a car full of beautiful women that drive by.
Yeah,
and they just kind
of, I guess,
like,
it's hard to tell.
They just kind of like brush him off, and he's like, "Man, it's nothing but ugly chicks and people who are already going steady that come out here. Where's all the single people?" You know, because he's commenting on how no women are paying attention to him.
Right. I don't know. He just feels like a shit.
He's a very Richard Dreyfuss character.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where half the things he says is like, I can't tell if you're like, if I should punch you or not.
It's so funny that they're like, I'm in high school. And I'm like, I disagree, no, Richard. Again, he's 3 years from Jaws, where he looks fucking 50 in that movie.
He looks so different in Jaws.
Yeah. I'm like, what a difference a beard makes. Holy shit.
A beard in 3 years.
Yeah. But yeah, Ron Howard is basically like, we should see other people, or like, we should have an open relationship. And he's essentially dumping this lady before college. And then he's always kind of a shit to her for the, like, he's just treats her like crap.
He
sucks. She doesn't want to dance with him later. And he's like, what the fuck, dance with me? And like, grabs her. And like, it's like, you just broke up with her, basically. And then she gets back with him at the end. And I was like, that's lame. But then he doesn't go home, or he doesn't leave.
Yeah.
They have
sort of like the reverse kind of problem, where like, he's gung ho. He wants to kick the dirt of this town off of his heels and leave everything behind. And he's sort of like really enamored with this idea of going out and chasing this vague promise of the future and leaving behind all this really good stuff that he has that he's taking for granted. And meanwhile, Kurt is like reaching back, like he ends up like going on a ride with one of his ex-girlfriends, like he's watching Leave It to Beaver. He wants to go to the high school dance, like the freshman dance. He's like, you know, for old time's sake, like he's like reaching back because he's really scared about leaving all the things he knows behind for an uncertain future. And they sort of end up swapping positions by the end of the movie.
Kurt is Ricky, right?
Kurt is Dreyfuss. Yeah.
Yeah. And then he has his thing is he gets in with greasers and basically has like a with the
well, pharaohs. he learns he can take risks because that's his thing. Right. They keep telling him, oh, you're too buttoned up. You're too afraid of taking risks. It's this whole thing. He's afraid of going off to school just because he's afraid of the unknown.
This woman smiles at him.
Yeah. That's right. This lady smiles at him in this white car, and she's just this big metaphor driving around the strip all night.
Yeah, and he's
this
chasing
big
her,
metaphor
basically.
for the uncertainty of this future that he could, you know, at the risk, but it could be really great and glamorous, and you don't know its possibilities.
And he has to go find Wolfman to do
Wolfman
is a radio
Jack.
DJ who's a real guy.
Wolfman Jack's a real guy. Yeah, that's the other thing. Yeah. He's like he was a big guy around this time, and he's sitting there listening to Wolfman Jack. It's like the voice of his childhood. Like, you know, we all had our favorite hometown DJs and stations growing up. And Like the sound, there is no score to the film. It's all just pop music from the day played over the radio by Wolfman
which
Jack.
Is apparently one of the first films to do that, which is wild to me. That's the concept of doing this.
Yeah, so I think we do have to give George Lucas a lot of credit.
Oh yeah,
because
no,
this
again, I understand.
He created this movie.
Yeah, I understand why this movie was a big deal when it came out. I totally do understand that. And I haven't quite fully described why I don't like this movie, but I wanted to go through the plot.
For sure.
And then we have what? We have the McLovin, we have Ron Howard, Richard Dreyfuss, and then we have like the guy who gets the girl who's way too young, who is trying
John
to find
Miller.
Harrison Ford to race him.
He's like the town, the local tough guy slash burnout. He works at the auto yard. He drives a hot rod. He's a known racer. He's the best. He's been the best for a while, but he's not going to college. He's not going anywhere.
Right.
And he's kind of a nihilist. And he hears that Harrison Ford is in town. There's this new guy in town with his badass hot rod. He's looking for you, John. But yeah, then he gets saddled with Mackenzie Phillips, who is like 13 in this movie.
She's my favorite character. She's hilarious.
They are my favorite characters, yeah.
Yeah, because she's just like weird and hates herself in this weird way.
And is just like kind of
a monster.
Yeah.
Like she's still not likable. Like there's a part where he gets pulled over or something and she's like, I'm going to tell him you raped me. And it's like, what the fuck, lady? Jesus Christ. Like they're all monsters. They're all weird and unhinged in my opinion. But like she was at least the most likable one. She had the vibes of like the babysitter in Incredibles. Like she had that weird like ultra talkative like weirdo vibe that I was like, "Oh, she's fun."
Yeah, but there was even a little bit, I mean that's the sort of darkness throughout the movie. Like she has a line, it's real quick, but they're listening to Wolfman Jack after they sort of started to bond. Cause the deal is she won't tell him where she lives so he can drop her off. And he's not going to drop her off. Cause he tries to just leave her.
He's not a scumbag.
Right. He tries to just leave her at the drive-in, but she walks off and these other fucking teens are like, there's some darkness in this movie.
Again. Oh, well, that's the thing. Even the main characters, like the McLovin character, I should mention that when he gets with that lady, it's by him like lurking, driving next to her.
Yeah.
The way like everybody, again, women are just sort of commodities.
They're like prey. They get traded between cars. That's their role in this movie, is to be traded between cars.
Right. And I honestly can't tell if the movie knows that.
I don't think it's aware of it.
Yeah.
Well, I think it is, but it doesn't. It is and it isn't. Like,
that's
it's aware of it enough to show us.
Feel.
Yeah, it's aware of it enough to show us, like, what Laurie's going through to an extent, but not that much. But she doesn't get an epilogue. And Mackenzie Phillips, Carol, doesn't get an epilogue. So you're right.
Yeah,
and Debbie doesn't get an epilogue either.
Yeah, I really don't think the movie is
I don't think he's aware of it, no.
And that is actually the core. The core of why I didn't like this movie is the whole movie, and this is all this is Dazed and Confused, this is Clerks, every teen hangout has this added vibe of, isn't this cool? Like, they all kind of have this undertone of that, right? Like, look at what we were doing. Isn't this fun and cool? Look at these greasers. Aren't they kind of dangerous? And my answer to all of that was not really. Like, I don't like car culture. I just don't. I find it silly. No offense to people who are into cars. And this idea of like boomers driving around in these $1,000 cars. They're $1,000. The guy
some
is like
some of them were like $800, Dave.
Yes. And
some
and,
of them were like,
and then,
well, yes, he was going to sell this guy a Corvette for $1,000.
And the idea of this movie is it's framed around, this is where it's the test of time thing. It's framed around Vietnam, right? So he's trying to show, look how on top
of
the world
we were. They don't even mention it until the end.
Yes.
I think.
But again, everybody watching it in the 70s knows that context,
right? Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what I'm talking about. So the attitude is, look how on top of everything we were. Look how great everything was. Watching it now, there is more than just Vietnam now in between myself and this movie, right? There is climate change. There is income inequality. There is the fact that, like, no one can afford a house. So watching these young boomers just be like, look how fucking great this is. Oh, our cars are so cheap and nothing matters. We're going to crash one of them. I'm on top of the world. It just sort of made me go like, fuck you. Like, fuck all of you, you fucking boom. Like, again, it's not logical. It has nothing to do with the movie. It's just right. Like, and then none of the stuff they were into, I was into. And like, when they're like, look how dangerous these greasers are. They're stealing from an arcade. And I'm like, I don't.
Yeah, they're stealing money out of the pinball machines at the Moose Lodge.
Yeah, and it's like, and
from
so it's all
two
the same.
Old men. Like, if the yeah. old men had been like, hey, they just would have beaten those old men senseless and robbed them anyway.
Right. And yeah, and so it's all to say that it's like the framing of this style movie being like, look how cool and amazing and on top of the world we are, feels like hubris now to me. In a way that I'm like, I'm so removed from this culture. That
yeah,
I
can see
that they're like aliens. Yeah.
I do want to directly address the we're on top of the world thing, because I don't think that's what this movie is saying.
Well, I assumed it was in the framing of Vietnam, where they're like, you know, this is the peak before the fall, right?
Well,
like,
even then, it's throughout. There's stuff woven throughout that's like showing us the cracks in the artifice of how America was perfect before Vietnam.
Right. Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
Like, we get that line from Mackenzie Phillips in the. I'm just going to go through a list of like little stuff that's kind of like throughout the movie.
Yeah.
Like Mackenzie Phillips says when they're listening to Wolfman Jack. She says, "My mom doesn't ever lets me listen to Wolfman Jack because he's a Negro," which he's not, but it doesn't matter. Like,
right.
She just kind of says that really quick, and they move on.
Right.
I was like, all right, we're reminded. I have a couple of things written down.
That was one of the things I was I think I heard that line, but I was thinking about that where it's like everybody's so white, and I do think you're right is that they are aware of that at least. There's also the teacher.
The teacher at the dance is having a very obvious inappropriate relationship with students. He calls the teen girls sexy.
Right. Because I do think it's like if we made a movie about the 80s, we would add those little bits in, right? Like the realization of like, it's not perfect. Like this isn't Stranger Things. I like Stranger Things, but Stranger Things is a very romanticized look at the 80s for the most part. I know
mm-hmm.
they do.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, 100%.
They handle a little of it, but it's just like.
I think this is more honest. Like with.
Yeah, like you're saying, it does have little bits.
It just said it's constant throughout too, like everything with Steve, like Ron Howard, like how awful he is. He's terribly selfish. He takes it all for granted. He's dumping Lori the night before he's about to leave. We mm-hmm. get, it's very subtle, but we know he's cheated on her.
Right.
He tries to force her into having sex.
Yes. He's just, it's an arc, right? He starts one way, yeah.
Yeah, there's even a little bit of strangeness that gets revealed there where he references that Lori has told him that she either walked in on her brother masturbating or has watched him do it before. That's when she kicks him out of the car. Or at least has watched her brother having sex before.
Right.
It's weird. The fact that Mackenzie Phillips ends up in John's car to begin with, because he's trying to pick up these older girls that are his age in the car, and they're like, well, you can take Jane's little sister. He's like, sure, I'll take Jane's sister or mom. Come on over. Send her into this car with this strange man.
Right, and there's this underlying vibe of like, aren't you glad it's this guy and not another guy? Because he's sort of like the way he gets her to give her address is he basically pretends to hit on her.
Yeah.
So that he comes on to her. And it's like that realization of like, this is too real and she's too young for this. She doesn't actually want this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of the movie pointing out like, he could have just been this type of guy.
Yeah,
from
what
the
if
start.
He was that guy? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's lucky again that, anyway. I have so much like little stuff written down, but all the characters are surrounded by death in the movie.
Yeah.
Like Bob Falfa, who's the Harrison Ford character, is spends the whole movie. We hear about him for a little bit before we actually see him. And point of fact, we actually hear him first. We hear his engine first.
Right.
And they're like, oh, it's that guy. I bet it's that guy looking for you. And John's like, yeah, he knows where to find me. But we see he's driving this jet black car with a skull ornament hanging from
the
mirror.
It's a cool car. That's the one car
following John through the city.
Yeah, you're right.
The Pharaohs are the motorcycle gang that take, you know, the famous dead kings are the ones that take Dreyfus under their wing and sort of they teach him that, oh, you can take risks, but like looking at he's like looking at his ex-girlfriend that like he has a when he goes on a drive with her and her friend and starts to make out with her for a little bit and realizes it's not like they're still pretty juvenile. Like they're not they're like kind of arrested development a little bit. They're kind of stuck and he's not really into that. And then he gets he's watching Leave It to Beaver
or?
And it's yeah, I'm talking about Kurt before he gets to the Pharaohs.
Oh yeah.
Like yes. His journey before he gets to the Pharaohs. But when he gets to the Pharaohs, they're the ones that show him like he can take risks, but they're also kind of showing him like if you stick around, you're probably going to end up in the Pharaohs because they're like, "Yeah, we want you in the gang." And he's like, "I don't know." Yeah. It's like, "Well, you can't. We don't just let anybody in the gang." So if he hangs around, these guys are going to be bothering him at the very least.
Right. But and they were pretty fun. Like they were low stakes, but
they were
when they fuck up that cop car, I was like, "Oh, good on them."
He rips the axle out. Yeah, but they're a gang, right? They're going to end up in prison or dead,
right? Yeah. Greasers are funny to me because they're sort of like pirates now, and what I mean by that is like. I don't doubt that they were dangerous. It's just that they've been like Disney-fied over the years where I see a greaser and I see a Halloween costume now. And it's like anything else. But I imagine it's like punks where it's like, yeah, they were kind of dangerous, but probably not that dangerous.
Not that dangerous, yeah.
Yeah. And then, I mean, like, everybody was a little dangerous in the 60s.
And the last big thing I had was like John himself is like, he's just like a total nihilist. He thinks it's his destiny to be killed in a wreck racing because that's the only thing anyone respects him for. Like he works at the auto yard and he takes Carol on a walk through there later. And this is not subtle, but he's pointing out all the wrecks of the different cars. Like, yeah, that's Ronnie from he was the best 10 years ago. This is he beefed it on a bridge. This is how he bought it. And that's Teddy's wreck. He was the best this many years ago, and he beefed it here. Oh, he took somebody with him, though. It's hard when you take somebody with him. And then he literally calls it a graveyard. So it's like not like they want you to understand that he's walking through the graveyard where he eventually expects to be buried.
His arc is basically it's the ending where it's like Harrison Ford almost joins the graveyard and almost takes someone with him. And it's like this near miss. Looked away. I thought Harrison Ford was in that car when it lit up.
When it exploded.
I was like, oh shit! Yeah, but then they cut away to him.
And it's interesting at that point. Like they see the near miss and it rolls and explodes and Harrison Ford and Laurie barely get out alive and you know it's he's witnessed this near miss and he's standing there with Teddy or Terry. I'm sorry, the nerd Charles Martin Smith is like, yeah, you're the he's like. He has his epiphany. Like he has his moment of realization where he's like, nah, he was beating me. He was breaking away. I'm too old. He was going to win if he hadn't spun out. And Charles Martin Smith, Terry kind of talks him back into it. He's like, no, you had it from the jump. You were always going to beat him.
Right.
You're always going to be number one. And then he's standing there looking at the flaming car and all of his friends that, you know, they just missed this tragedy. He's standing there with Terry. He's like, yeah, you know what? Screw it. Fine. I'll take them all as they come. And those are the two characters that die in 2 years.
Yeah.
Like he almost has his epiphany and he gets talked out of
it
by Terry the Toad.
I like that about this movie, the general vibes of like, you know, it ends with Richard Dreyfuss on the plane and he looks down from the plane and he sees that fucking white Mustang, I believe, with the lady in it. And
but
it's
driving
like
the same direction out of town with him. It's the he's following the possibility, you know, the allure of possibility.
It's about that time in your life where you just there's so many paths,
options.
In front of
yeah,
you.
There's so many paths,
and you are it's terrifying because it's like some of those paths will lead to death. Some like it,
and
it's
even,
just like that's
right.
how it's and there's no way to know. It's just the
right. And even if it's not,
you,
even if it's not
like,
so many paths, I just wanted to
so
say because in this movie, I think for most of the characters, it's just two.
It's horrifying.
Like it, but it's still an agonizing. It's an agonizing choice. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it absolutely is. And so again, like I get it. I get it with this film. It's more of like, I just don't like these people or what they're into. I don't like watching this type of hanging out. I'm
That's
like,
fair. It is. It's.
I watched this and I was like, yeah, I see what the Zodiac was doing. I understand the Zodiac a little more now. I'm like, yeah,
I love
these kids.
Yeah, man.
I will say one thing I liked about this era, as represented by this movie, is I think they swear better. What I mean by that is Ron Howard specifically says, quote, "We're finally getting out of this turkey town." And I was like, hell yeah, Ron. Hell yeah.
When he tells the teacher later to kiss a duck.
Go kiss a duck, Marblehead. And I was like, yeah, that's awesome.
And it
that's
fucking deflated that. It eviscerated him when he said that.
Yeah, he ruined that guy.
Yeah, it shut
like
him down.
Punch him.
The guy lost his words after that.
Yeah, it's like, damn, Ron.
Cut him like a knife.
Yeah. So, like, yeah, that's, I don't know. It's just more creative speech, you know? Like, it's, I don't know, maybe not. I mean, we can still say ghost kiss a duck, and we can also say like motherfucker and all
go
these
kiss
other
a
things.
Motherfucking duck.
Exactly. So it's up to us.
Yeah.
The world is what we make of it.
Really? See, we're still crippled by too many choices.
Yeah.
I love the gut punch of the epilogue. Because it's like they're all saying goodbye. It's kind of this bittersweet but still hopeful as he takes off and he's holding this little radio, listening to his radio station for as long as he can until he loses his signal. And Dreyfuss looks down and sees the white car driving along with them. And he's like, ah, yeah. And the first thing we see is John Milner was killed 2 years later by a truck driver.
It's very funny.
Terry was missing in action, declared killed in action in 1964 or whatever. And then it's... Right. So the two guys that didn't make it out died. And then it gets to Ron Howard, who stayed. And it's
he becomes an insurance salesman,
which is. I don't want to shit on it because it's not. But it's like, and the movie's not shitting on it, but so the first two guys die. And then the third person is Ron Howard. He's an insurance salesman. Fourth person is Dreyfuss. It's like he's a writer in Canada. So he got far away and is doing like this, you know, this quote unquote prestigious or highfalutin job. And Ron Howard is stayed at home and is doing a less glamorous job, but is, you know, like a family man job.
Yeah.
So it's like it shows us kind of like they had all of this angst about all of their possibility. And then we see the very simple trajectories of their lives.
Right. And that's how most
and
things
it's a,
go.
Such a gut punch.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. It's kind of telling coming from Lucas where it's that he is identifying these people by their jobs. And what I mean by that is like we I'm sure we can relate. We're in industries where we're very ambitious in terms of careers, where like I personally don't plan to have a family. And so like for me, it's like, yeah, that's how I'm judging things. But it's just interesting because when they say insurance salesman, you could guess like, oh, maybe he doesn't have a family. Maybe this he's single. But like it's just interesting to define Ron Howard by his job, where his decision at the end is more about I'm going to settle down here with this person. And so you'd think it would be, oh, he has a family. He's a father. He has this many kids. It doesn't really matter what he does. I don't know. But like, and then Dreyfuss, you kind of get that vibe of like, yeah, him as a writer in Alaska, that is kind of the thing. That feels more like he's the closest to following his dream, right, of everybody else. Where it's like, it's not exactly what he wants. It's just like, yeah, like you said, this kind of like romantic... successful job as opposed to the you stayed in your hometown,
not,
you're doing this job. But it's like jobs don't define people. They don't define to success.
No,
you get
it is a good shorthand to get a good sense of sort of how a person landed. I also think it's just an oversight by Lucas, because I mean we still do that today, but like in this era you're very much defined by what your profession is.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at, is that he's also in an industry that is very much defined by your profession.
Yeah.
So like I he's making the mistake that honestly I also make in my head, which is like defining people by their jobs. And yeah, it's also the era and stuff like that. It's interesting because like this made me laugh, and like again, it's a lot of this has to do with time, right? Where we've seen this ending. versions of this ending so many times. And so it was funny to see it done like these like yearbook photos on this blue sky to Beach Boys about how they fucking like two out of four of them are dead.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, this is, I don't know why this is tickling me. But I think, like you said, the point is, look at this cheery song and this not so cheery, or this really grounded epilogue. You know,
it's the cracks and the pristine memory, right? And it's I appreciate that, like, even the quote unquote dream job, he never talked about being a writer, really. He was going to go into like political science and meet the president and stuff. It's not what he talked about doing,
right?
I appreciate that, where it's still like an attractive career, like a glamorous career, but it's not what he thought he was going to do.
The older I get, the more I understand this trope, which is like, I understand, you know, we've always had this, right? Like, we never left Vietnam for so long with movies. And now we're kind of creeping into the 80s. And now we're even getting to like I saw Drive Away Dolls, where it takes place in 1999. I was like, oh, we're almost getting to like 2000s nostalgia. We're getting there. But like, there's this profoundness when you're an adult where you can see entire lifetimes.
Yep.
You can look back at people you know and go, like, especially when your friends start dying, you can say, like, I basically knew that person from beginning, middle, and end of their entire time on this earth.
Yep.
And there's something profound in that, of showing, like, the early time and then saying, and this is how it's going to end up. It's interesting watching this from the perspective of Lucas, who is probably, what, 20? 25?
He's very young at this point. I'm not sure exactly how old he is, but
I almost want him to make a version of this now, where he has those years behind him, where he can, I mean, it's hard because, like, you know, he's lived, I would argue, a pampered life, not like a life that's necessarily what everybody else's life is like, but it's still interesting. Like, you know, that's the age to do this sort of retrospective thing, I feel like. Because I want to know, like, what does he think about it now? Because he's a pretty liberal guy. Like, he probably has recognized, like, boomers, this generation has made a lot of mistakes. And I kind of want to know, like, what would someone say about that now? Make American Graffiti, too. I know there already is one.
More American Graffiti?
Yeah.
It resurrects John Milner. He doesn't die.
Really?
Yeah, he becomes, like, a cop, I think, which is worse.
Oh, that's
it's worse for him.
Why would they even make a sequel? That's so funny.
I don't know. It's real. I don't think Lucas had anything to do with it. Anyway,
no,
we don't have to talk about it.
I mean,
why
I kind of wanted.
Would you make a sequel to this movie?
It's such a funny idea. What a dumb thing to do. I don't know. I I still like this. Even everything we're talking about, I think this is a premise that got honed in. Like, Dazed and Confused, I think, is a more honed-in version.
Yeah, I think this meanders for too long, for sure.
Yeah. It sort of gives them a little more, like, Dazed and Confused has a little more of a goal, has a little more of arcs, has a little more of, like, all right, let's have a villain. Let's have Ben Affleck be there, you know? And we got to dump shit on him, and we got to humiliate Ben Affleck. And so, like, this one felt like it was resting, like, and it is probably because it's such an early version, it was resting entirely on, look at this, they're just hanging out, you know? And, I mean, like, in those first 50 minutes where they're just driving around and there's music playing and it's vibes, I was just not vibing with it. I was just like, yeah, I don't.
Yeah, that's when the movie's its most indulgent, I think. That and at the dance, where it, like, really, like, lingers on the footage of this band playing at this high school dance. I'm like, this is just George being like, wasn't it great to be a kid in 1962?
Yeah. Like, I don't know, man.
I don't fucking know, dude.
Yeah, doesn't seem that way, but all right.
Sure seems great to be a white kid in 1962. Yeah,
exactly.
There are three black kids at the dance. Yeah. I counted.
No, yeah, it is. That's, again, it's like, I know that might be part of the point, but it's just hard because it's just so much hubris, and then it's all these white guys
with these
just being like, everything's great and
gunboat,
inexpensive
Cadillacs and all these, like, hot rod, all these cars, man.
Yeah, these things that it's like, they're like, let's go out and buy some houses for cheap. Like, I was waiting for that. Like, it's just like, come on, you fuckers. Like,
it's, yeah, just seeing a car was $800 written in the window for a new car.
It's bullshit.
Fuck that
absolute
generation.
Yeah.
What did y'all do?
Yeah, you fucked us.
What
y'all
happened?
Celebrate.
Oh, man.
Diner. Listen to Wolfman. Again, everything's so early. Even Wolfman, they're like, yeah, he's nuts. Look at, listen to Wolfman. And listen to his prank phone call. And his prank phone call, which is with George Lucas, his cameo, ends with the guy just going like, oh, I think you have a long number, and hanging up. And it's like, that's barely a prank call, Wolfman. Like, it was just him like being kind of zany. And the guy going,
pretty tame, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And everybody's like, oh, he was nuts. And I'm like, no, he wasn't. You honkies.
Yeah, but, he's flying around in an airplane so they can't ever track down his signal. I'm like, to play whack-ass prank call tapes?
Yeah. But again, it's like, this was when we were discovering
Dr. Demento shit.
Yeah. So again, I get it. Like, in the 70s, this shit was probably a little more fresh. And now it's just like, we've had so much between it that it just doesn't land as well with me, at least. You know.
Yeah.
It's not the movie's fault. It's just not. I have nothing else.
Yeah, I pretty much got through everything I wanted to say. I'm surprised I found as much to talk about it this time through as I did. I didn't necessarily pick up on all of the sort of grim undercurrents running through this movie.
Yeah. I'm glad you did, because it gives it a little more context of why this perhaps won, or I think it was only nominated, but why this thing was like it was nominated for like 5 fucking things at the Oscars. It was, yeah, and it makes sense in the context of like, how do you go from all this to Star Wars? And it's just interesting thinking about this era and Spielberg and Lucas, and like, what is the equivalent of that today? And it's like, what are the young filmmakers that are kind of just starting out that, you know,
I don't know.
Would slowly,
I'm sure we could come up with a list.
Oh yeah. I mean, I don't mean even in style or anything like that. Like, I mean like in like just career, where they are career wise. It's just interesting, very interesting to watch this like early director who talking about the path that you're going to have in life without knowing he's about to make one of the biggest films ever.
Yeah.
Like, that's nuts. That's just so weird to me. It
will be pretty much the only thing he does for the rest of his life.
Yes. Like, it's amazing. Cause like, yeah, there was a beautiful webcomic I just saw of George Lucas filming Star Wars and Mark Hamill being like, so the blue milk, what's with that? And him just like, yeah, no, it's like space milk or whatever. Let's go to the next shot. And then the next panel is just him walking through the supermarket, older, filled with blue milk. Because you see, they just released a blue milk.
Oh, man.
And it's like, yeah, I would love to tell Lucas, like, these little weird decisions you make without any thought are going to become your legacy.
Mm-hmm.
Blue milk is going to define who you are all the way to your death.
You're going to make so much money selling tiny plastic versions of these characters.
Yeah, that you thought up while high, I assume.
You can tell by the names.
Yeah.
I have been told that Star Wars fans can correct me, but I have been told that that is the reason why every Star Wars character has like a specific name. And it's because they went through it for the action figures.
Yeah, of course. It's both like very endearing and makes me even hate boomers more, where it's like the story of the Ninja Turtles, where it's like, oh, they were in a bar while high and they thought
right,
them
it was
up.
So easy. And it's nothing, like, and there's your legacy. There was so much left to invent back then.
Yeah, exactly. That's all you had to do. What if they're Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles? Bam. You're rich.
Somebody
you're fucking
got
rich.
To invent microwave pizza, Dave. Somebody got to invent putting a pizza in the microwave, and they got to invent it. Within the last 70 years.
Motherfuckers. Yeah. Anyway.
American Graffiti.
American Graffiti. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
To Harrison Millie. This was an experience. I had not seen it before, so I'm glad I watched it. Thank you guys. This was through our Patreon. Patreon.com/gamefullyunemployed. GameFully Unemployed. We watch movies every Friday night with our patrons. That's through our Discord community. We also have exclusive podcasts like Tom and Jeff Watch Batman, Fox Mulder is a Maniac, Star Trek The Next Futurama, and Spiel Boys. We have like tiers where you can get these custom We Just Watched episodes too. That's how this came to be. So check all that out.
Do it. We also have a store. Head over to gamefieldunemployed.com where you can find a link to our Teespring store where we have all kinds of cool original artwork and designs you can get on t-shirts, mugs, stickers, posters, all sorts of things. So slap your graffiti peepers on that.
Yeah.
Your Howlin' Wolfman peepers.
Hey, listen, our music is produced by Chris Corlew. You can find him on Twitter.com as The Corlew or go to shipwreckedsailor.bandcamp.com. Our channel artwork is produced by Michael Vincent Bramley. For more of his work, go to mvbramley.art. Our episode artwork is by Justin Brown, available on Twitter as Justin T. Brown or at artnessbyjustinbrown.com. And finally, additional artwork is by Starlene Hodge. You can find her work at starlenearts.com or on Twitter as Starlene X. Cool. Goodbye.